content to know that the only reason for her presence was the proselytizing of her faith to the homeless and desperate. A custodian was not such a rare sight that he drew unwelcome attention, but to get closer to such gatherings he would have to divest himself of his armour, which seemed unwise, given that the palace was under direct attack. Earlier that day, Colonel Neck had been summoned to a council of senior officers, arranged at the instigation of Valdor on request from Amon. He had left the request, and then initiated Blood Games protocols, on the assumption that the Lectitio Divinitatis could extend as high as the Imperial Senate members. He could not afford for anyone to influence his mission, nor risk any report of it passing beyond the Legio Custodes. Vox silent, he had single-mindedly tracked Neck without any further communication with his order, and would make no contact until he was ready to make his report. Brought to the Sanctum Imperialis, Neck Fiasna had used the opportunity to make contact with several other heralds of the Lectitio Divinitatis. She had barely attempted secrecy. Such was the growing confidence of the cult that they would not be prosecuted. It was not Amon's decision to make, but he was of a mind to argue for a very visible and memorable chastisement. Amon could understand their weakness of spirit, but he could not forgive it. Neck had also been granted a leave of 12 hours before being posted back to her commander. The first 6 she had used for rest and sampling some black market luxuries. Nothing specifically contraband, just consumables that were becoming very rare, like fresh water, menthol low sticks, and some mild alcoholic beverages. Amon had been on the verge of following up some of her contacts he had discovered, when he realized that he had been party to a well-organized deception. It was not aimed at him specifically, but the more obvious meetings and exchanges had been intended as lures for anyone following the colonel. 6 hours of low-grade indulgence provided the perfect opportunity for any move to arrest Colonel Neck, and at the same time offered cover for a far more subtle communication. After all, what did a colonel have to exchange for rare goods? Currency had rapidly fallen out of favour, except among the most optimistic dealers, who thought it would have value after the siege was lifted. For most, it was information or barter. But Neck Vyazna had not been misappropriating supplies. The same applied to sensitive data that her position afforded her. There was no evidence she was betraying the trust of her military rank. That left only spiritual exchange. If his suspicions were confirmed, he was following Neck to a secret gathering of faithful inside the Sanctum Imperialis, consisting perhaps of a few high-ranking officials with dealings in the black market themselves. The illicit trade was a convenient mask for those wishing to communicate about an even more sensitive issue, and those that acted as vendors would be as likely to trade information about faith and the Emperor's divinity as they were power cells and rations packs purloined from front-line consignments. She faded into the thousands-strong sprawl of humanity that swelled around the processional 16 gate, where almoners from the palace distributed medical and nutritional packages to the needy. Amon's research had shown that burgeoning religions frequently preyed upon the least fortunate for support, and he expected the Lectitio Divinitatis was no different. Reaching the conveyor at the far side of the terrace, he lost sight of Neck, but he was not concerned. Her particular scent, enhanced by illegal beer and pungent low sticks only an hour earlier, would make her easy to track, even through the interior of the palace. Descending to almost ground level, Amon crossed to the outer districts of the Senatorum building, about 300 meters from where the Via Principa ended at the huge Bastion Argentus. Once inside, he picked up Colonel Neck's trail near the Concordia Central, and from there followed it until he had her within sight in the concourse leading to the Hall of Widows. He saw her enter by a side door, and ascended several floors to come upon a sentry balcony overlooking the main hall. As he approached, he found the sentry post unguarded, the guards doubtless relieved from duty while the conspiratorial gathering took place. Slipping inside, he picked up the babble of voices from below, far louder than he was expecting. Moving up to the curtained edge, he peered down into the amphitheatre, and saw that there was at least 100 people gathered. Others were still entering. At the same time he observed this, Amon's senses prickled, drawing his eye to one of the other sentry balconies on the opposite side of the hall, about 3 stories lower down. A woman of middle years was standing there looking directly at him. She was blonde, pale-skinned, dressed in a long skirt of light blue and darker blue blouse. She picked up the closed vox dialer on the wall, and an instant later the device installed on his balcony purred into life. He answered it.
"How are you here?" he asked.
He had recognized the woman the moment he had laid eyes on her. Like many of those detained by Dawn or Malkador, her image had been circulated amongst the custodians in case she somehow escaped her confinement. Now she was looking at Amon with a wry smile, obviously expecting him.
Euphrati Keeler.
Chapter 17. Technophage. Unexpected assistance. Smoke and fire. Lion Primus Strategium. 4 days since assault. Mran disliked red lights and sirens. The Lion Primus Strategium was alive with both in strobing, screaming harmony. Though he was immune to panic, lesser soldiers were not, and he felt that sudden clamour was a poor way to bring about quick, clear thinking. Despite his misgivings, the adjutants, logistaria, and legionaries moved with brisk purpose from console to console, updating the primary and secondary displays in wake of the latest alert. Schematics of the Lionsgate spaceport flashed up on every screen, covered with warning symbols and scrolling runes. It was almost an hourly occurrence, as fresh enemy attacks from above and below assailed the defenders. Surveyor malfunctions and system errors had made a mockery of trying to predict their landings and movements, and this time it appeared as though the entire port was on the verge of being overrun. It was impossible. The enemy were far from such a victory, but the sight of hostile signal returns throughout his command zone was a shocking reminder of what Ran was trying to prevent.
"Shut off that noise and those lights too," he snapped.
Ran leaned over the main display table, trying to take in the sudden wealth of information. He rounded on the logisteria at the control panel.
"How is this happening?"
The tech priest clicked and warbled for a few moments, brass eye lenses dilating and narrowing several times within the folds of her red hood.
"There has been another noospheric intrusion, Commander Ran."
"Well, that's not an answer."
Ran waved a hand at the data still accumulating on the display.
"Is this real or not?"
"There have been confirmed enemy landings on the Mesafix platforms, Commander Ran. There have been confirmed enemy contacts in the Stratafix core, Commander Ran. There are ongoing engagements in the Tropafix skin and mantle zones, Commander Ran."
"But many of these signals are false? Errors?"
The logisteria worked the panel controls, and a pulse of static rippled across the display, in places turning some of the red data sigils blue, and in others green. There was still a lot of red all across the spaceport. Much of the base was swathed in green, which Ran took as a good sign until the logisteria spoke.
"The green runes signify confirmed contacts with enemy weighted 80 or more on the threat factoring scale employed by my dataset, Commander Ran. The blue runes signify confirmed contacts with enemy weighted 30 or less on the threat factoring scale employed by my dataset, Commander Ran. The red runes signify unconfirmed contacts with enemy of unknown weighting on the threat factoring scale employed by my dataset, Commander Ran."
"So the red ones are fakes?"
"Unknown. The red runes may represent legitimate but unconfirmed enemy contacts of variable threat level, Commander Ran."
"Do what you can to confirm the reports and scrub the rest," he told the Martian.
He gave the screen one last inspection, trying to see if strategic experience could tease any truth from the clusters of flashing icons. If he looked at the patterns in a certain way, there appeared to be a general movement from the uppermost levels down. There were certainly enemy in the surrounding areas of the bridgeways and monorail connections to the main Lion's Gate. The connecting rails and roads were well defended, but if they were to fall into the hands of the enemy, the traitors would be within striking distance of the gatehouse itself. Ran knew his strengths and the limitations of his authority, and both were being tested by the impending crisis.
"Comms, I need an urgent connection to Lord Dawn. Urgent."
"Yes, Commander. Prioritizing a command vox for you."
He felt like he should be reeling off orders to deal with what was happening. But the truth was Hager was already in place to make those decisions. The majority of his field commanders were experienced enough to assess for themselves the local situation, better than he could with unreliable battle data. He checked the display again, but it was no clearer than 30 seconds earlier.
Commander, I have Lord Dorne's equerry in Vox contact. Tell him I need the Primarch. I need to speak with him immediately.
There was a quiet exchange between the legionary and the equerry at the other end of the Voxlink. For the first time in several years, the commander heard several Inuit curse phrases, including a pointed comment that the listener would go into an ice storm without a coat, one of the gravest insults from Rand's homeworld.
"Shall I connect the channel to the briefing room, Commander?"
the Vox operator suggested, nodding his head towards the adjacent chamber.
"That seems sensible," replied Rand,
realizing that some discretion might be needed in the circumstances. Rand strode into the chamber and sat down at the broad oval desk within, punching the Vox connecting button set into a rune pad upon its surface. The speaker built into the ceiling hissed into life.
"I'm conducting contra-siege operations against the Death Guard attack, and Lieutenant Tacko is demanding an honor duel with your Vox officer. Explain quickly."
The Lord Seneschal took a breath, figuring out where to begin. There was no point trying to be coy about the situation.
"The defense of the Lionsgate fort is compromised, Lord Dorne. The traitors have made ground through the base, established a presence in Sky City, and in the last hour conducted massed landings in the docking spires. Our response is being hampered by an intervention through the new sphere and electronic systems, rendering augurs and comms erratic. Give me an assessment of the threat. Can you recover the situation?"
"It depends on what you want me to do, Lord Dorne. If I concentrate defences around the gate connections, I will have a static position that can hold for some time. If you want me to retake lost ground,
the attack in the base can be contained, but I think that if we do not press them in the Star Sphere, they'll have a steady reinforcement route. Of course, that will leave the bridges vulnerable." "Do not allow the enemy to gain a foothold. It sounds as though you have a plan. What do you want from me?"
"Permission to destroy the bridges, Lord Dorne."
"Denied. Retaining possession and access to the spaceport is preferable. Time is of the essence, and it may be the case that when Rebute Gilliman arrives, we will need the Lionsgate port to bring down his troops with sufficient speed to turn the battle. Every hour could be the difference between the Emperor's victory or defeat. The bridges also provide the means for a massed counterattack, should too much of the port be overrun."
Rand bit back the arguments that rose to his tongue, knowing that the Primarch had made up his mind.
"Understood, my lord. In that case, I request the dispatch of a second-ranking commander to ensure redundancy of leadership. I intend to take to the field to combat the enemy gains." "You have someone in mind?"
"First Captain Sigismund's presence would be invaluable."
Rand resisted the urge to drum his fingers on the table edge as he waited for Rogel Dorn's answer. That the request had not been turned down immediately was a good sign, he thought, but he started composing his arguments in favour of the decision just in case.
"I can spare 3,000 more legionaries. It will take some time to assemble them from across the palace, so that we are not weakened elsewhere. You will have to make do with that."
"They will be a great help, my lord. If possible, I would suggest a counter-aerial assault to coincide with a renewed offensive from my attack from Sky City."
"You want me to send Sigismund's force in by air?"
"That would be the swiftest way into the battle, my lord."
"I agree. I will have Sigismund contact you directly to work out the details once the strike force is ready to leave."
"Well, thank you."
The Vox hissed into dead static, the connection broken. Rand flicked the dial to his command channel.
"Lieutenant Commander Hager, bring my strategic council to the briefing room. We have a counterattack to plan."
He sat back in thought for a moment before activating the switch again.
"Have Major Stiverelax come as well. We need to discuss how to eliminate this new electronic threat. And have her bring her best demolitions experts."
Sanctum Imperialis, Central Zone, 3 days since assault. Looking across the expanse of the Hall of Widows, Euphrati Keeler watched the custodian carefully, the steady tempo of his breathing coming to her ear through the Vox receiver. He hadn't raised his weapon, which was encouraging only to a certain point. Her next words would frame the rest of their relationship. She wanted to tell him that the Emperor had guided her to this time and place, but a lesser truth would have to serve for now.
Malkador sent me to help you.
I see. How did you know I would be here?
I'm sorry, but you've been led on something of a false trail.
Explain.
You went into Shadowguise before Malkador could tell you that I would be assisting you. Your training meant you would ignore all Vox contact. I tried to find you, but had to give up, even though I knew you were following the Colonel. You're very good at what you do.
How did you know I would follow Colonel Neck to this place?
I wouldn't feel put out, Custodian Amon. It was Valdor himself that helped lay the bait once it was clear we could not contact you by conventional means. From your request, he deduced you would follow the lead of the Colonel, and Cinderman received word that she would come to this meeting. I thought I would have to wait a while longer, but you were very prompt.
Has this been some kind of trial? A reverse blood game to test my abilities?
She shook her head.
No, Custodian Amon. This is all very real. The apparition, the confession, the gathering you are witnessing was not staged for your benefit.
These are members of the Letitia Divinitatis, conspirators in the cult of the Emperor.
High-ranking, as you can see. They are unaware of our presence. I agreed to help you navigate the labyrinth of the Letitia Divinitatis. Conditional upon my aid was Malkador's promise that nobody within the cult would be prosecuted unless found guilty of some greater crime. You are here to uncover the source and scale of the demonic intrusion, not to wage war upon the Letitia Divinitatis.
I do not take orders from political agitators, nor does Malkador's oath bind me.
Keela sighed.
Firstly, without my help you will find out nothing.
The moment the Letitia Divinitatis knows you are seeking them, they'll disappear.
Secondly, perhaps you miss the meaning of Valdor's involvement. I am here with his full, blessing.
Amon stared at her silently for several seconds longer, not moving at all. His expression was impossible to read, a blank canvas of emotion. Eventually, he gave a perfunctory nod.
Very well. We need to agree our objectives and approach. There is a disused common area on the fourth level of the adjacent quarters. Do you know it?
I can find it. I'll meet you there in 10 minutes, Custodian.
He hung up the receiver without further acknowledgement, disappearing back through the curtains a heartbeat later. Keela slid her Vox handset back into its sconce and turned to lean her back against the wall next to it, letting the tension flow from her body. The curtain twitched.
Is it done?
A voice asked from the hallway beyond. She pulled back the curtain to reveal a silver-haired man, face lined with age. Despite his wizened features, he held himself straight, gaze firm, voice strong. He was every bit as imposing and charismatic as he had been at the height of his prowess as one of the iterators of the Imperial Truth. Kirill Cinderman, now her herald to the growing masses of the Letitia Divinitatis.
That went better than expected, she told him. Malkador warned that he is a hardliner when it comes to matters of faith. He was at Monarchia.
Perhaps that was why Valdor chose him for the task.
If Valdor wanted the Letitia Divinitatis eradicated, he would have ordered it so long before now. I think Custodian Amon has a talent for rooting out hidden things. Nothing more.
Even so, you cannot trust him too much. You are a saint. A valuable hostage.
Keela stepped through the curtain and answered with a smile.
Trust is a commodity that comes and goes, my dearest friend. Faith is eternal.
Nagapur Territories, 59 days before assault. An insistent banging and the stench of smoke woke Zenobi. She was still strapped to her gunnery chair, hanging over the control console. The armor glass of the dome was intact, heavily smeared and scratched, but through it she could see the bent barrels of the autocannons and the furrows they had scored through the dirt as the car had tipped off the track. The metallic clang of a hammer dragged her senses back inside. Between each blow she heard the crackle of flames, and through the ringing in her ears caught her name, very muffled from outside. She braced a foot against the side of the turret and unclasped the strap, falling sideways between the control console and the dome. From this new position, she could see that a panel had torn away, blocking the access ladder into the cupola. Flames flickered from the cables that had been exposed. The fire didn't seem very big, but it was between her and the route out. That was when she remembered the ammunition feed.
Help!
She slid boots first along the hatchway and slammed her foot against the twisted metal sheet.
I'm alive! I mean, here! Draw the ammo feed! There's a fire!
She battered the metal several more times, shouting for her companions to remove the ammunition belt feeds. The fire was growing in brightness, sputtering and flaring as it reached the lubricated turntable of the quad cannons. She worried that an electrical discharge might make the whole metal turret live and scrambled back, trying to wedge herself into the non-conductive armour glass dome, one rubber-soled boot pressed against the chair. A thump right behind her jolted her head back, banging it again. There were figures outside, scraping away at the grime that had accumulated on the dome. Member peered through, eyes shielded by his hands, a cry of relief becoming a short laugh as their eyes met. He grinned and said something, but the thick armour glass reduced it to meaningless mumbling.
"I can't hear you,"
she mouthed deliberately, shrugging her shoulders.
"There's a fire. You need to disconnect the ammunition before it blows."
He nodded and gave a thumbs up. Zenobi focused on his mouth as best she could, turning her body so that she was more or less parallel with him. Member nodded, but she couldn't tell if he had really understood. She raised her voice, shouting each word with careful intonation, while pointing back to the hatchway.
"Fire! Get me out of here!"
A few others gathered, their lasguns turned in their hands. They started hammering at the armour glass with the butts of their weapons, but the only discernible result was deafening noise within the turret.
"Stop! Stop!"
Zenobi waved her hands and then shielded her ears. Member noticed and called for the others to back away. Zenobi's eyes were stinging, and it was getting more difficult to breathe as smoke continued to fill the cupola. She swiveled around to look towards the ladderway. The fire was still burning within the exposed bulkhead. It wasn't large, but the fumes were acrid, a mix of burning lubricant and melting plastic. Looking around the turret revealed nothing that could put out the flames. The smoke was far more dangerous than the heat from the fire. Zenobi was almost unable to keep her eyes open, blinking hard all the time as tears streamed through the grime on her face. Every breath felt like inhaling razor blades. That was when an idea struck. Zenobi turned her attention back to the dome and signalled for Member and the others to move back. Almost blind, her fingers fumbling every delicate motion, she persisted. Every few seconds, coughs racked her, doubling her up. She eventually unlaced her boots and wedged them under the control pedals. A dizzy spell stopped her for several erratic heartbeats. She wanted to suck in air, but knew that would only make it worse. Next came the coverall, an even more awkward struggle in the confines of the turret. First one arm, then the other came free. A sudden crack and green flare from the entranceway marked the fire reaching some new source of fuel. The smoke became darker, leaving a black slick along the metal as it flowed up into the turret. She shifted to the rubberized seat, nearly lying down to pull the heavy uniform off her legs. Folding a rough rectangle, its arms and legs tucked inside, she put it to one side and drew her boots back on, still nervous about electrocution. She moved along the ladderway at a crouch, trying not to touch anything. The curls of her hair stood up with static, and the choking smoke was thick in her throat. With the folded coverall held out before her like a shield, she lunged forward, thrusting it into the exposed cable compartment. The thick folds of material fitted almost exactly, cutting off the air. Cautiously, she drew it back to see if there were any flames left. A spark from a severed wire caused her to flinch, but as far as she could see, the fire was gone. Zenobi filled the hole with her uniform just in case, hoping it wouldn't catch a light from a stray discharge. She started to kick at the cover that had come away to block the entry hatch.
"Can you hear me?"
There were voices and movement below. Lieutenant Okoye's face appeared in the small gap between dislodged sheet and floor.
"We are improvising a cutter out of the LASPAX. Step back."
"What about a melter?"
she replied.
"Too powerful. It might blast all the way up into the turret."
She obeyed, scuttling back up to the dome.
A hiss joined the symphony of other noises that creaked and rattled through the derailed car, and she saw a red glow appear on one corner of the lodged metal plate. Hammering resumed, bending the metal where it had been heated. Gloved hands grasped at the torn edge, twisting and pulling. Zenobi almost blacked out again, trying to breathe as little as possible. The fire was producing no more smoke, but there wasn't enough ventilation to let the trapped fumes escape. The sheet buckled. Almost unconscious, Zenobi threw herself towards it, slamming shoulder first into the metal. Corners screeched along the entranceway, but it gave under the impact, sending her, the metal, and several troopers sprawling into the main gangway. A shriek left her lips, coming from somewhere she hadn't known existed, quickly followed by a lungful of acrid but smoke-free air. She lay on the metal, eyes closed, chest heaving for several seconds, the heat from where the lascutter had melted it warming the back of her legs. It was this that reminded her she was dressed only in her undergarments. Slowly opening her eyes, she found herself with five troopers and Lieutenant Okoye looking down at her with a mixture of humour and amazement. Ketai was among them.
I need a drink, she croaked.
I have some water here,
said one of the other rescuers, pulling a canteen from her belt. Ketai met her gaze as she swigged down tepid water, a smile on his lips.
Let's get you outside, he said, draping an arm over her shoulder to lead her away, his other hand moving to the flask in his pocket. Chapter 18 Abaddon joins the attack. Among the masses. A question of faith. Lionsgate Spaceport, Mesifex Corps, 2 days since assault. There was a lot to be said for the simple pleasure of combat. Abaddon had always been a fighter, first and foremost. Born to be a king, he had chosen the road of battle rather than rulership, giving up that birthright to honour his bladekin. Wreathed in armour-shattering energy, his fist made short work of the 7th Legion warrior that barred his passage into the upper sensoria of the Lionsgate spaceport. Another fell to the sleeve blades of Laiak's bodyguards, while the sorcerer ended a third with a fork of black lightning from his staff. This was purity. To be victorious and live, or to know defeat and death. A clear foe, a defined objective. Abaddon's gun roared, a hail of bolts cracking open the plastron of an Imperial Fist's legionary in the livery of a veteran sergeant. He followed up with long strides, smashing his gauntlet into the broken armour, pulverizing bone and organs beneath, the blow hurling Dawn's fighter across the tiled floor. Bolt and blade did not care for allegiance, nor the wiles of priests and sorcerers. They were loosed for many reasons, honourable and vile, but once set on their way, they either hit their target or missed. Abaddon remembered a time of similar clarity, when he had been a legionary, newly recruited into the Lunar Wolves. Follow orders, kill the enemy, protect your brothers. Now he could barely stand to be in the same room as those he had once thought closest kin. He raised his blade alongside an abomination that paid service to powers existing beyond mortal comprehension. And, more than anything, he fought for a lord whose true ambitions were impossible to know. Despite his doubts, perhaps because of them, the first captain of the Sons of Horus was not content to be an observer during the Battle for Terror. Behind him came 3,000 Sons of Horus, their weapons raking fire through the warriors of Rogal Dawn. By Stormbird and Thunderhawk, they had been summoned, another blade aimed at the heart of the Lionsgate spaceport. It had not been by the order of Abaddon that they had come. Rather, they had been dispatched by the Warmaster on the word of Laiak. Though he had received no order himself, Abaddon had assumed command. Ezekiel Abaddon, first captain of the Sons of Horus, the right hand of the Warmaster, and victor of countless campaigns, had not come to Terror to watch others overthrow the Emperor. He would sooner die in battle than see a word-bearer's sorcerer lead the first of his battle brothers into the Imperial Palace. The line of yellow that held the hallways around the upper sensoria buckled under the attack, unable to hold against the ferocity of their newly arrived foes. In the close confines of the interior, Abaddon swapped his bolter for powered blade, so that with sword and gleaming fist he carved his path through to the objective.
With him came the Justarin, their Terminator warplate proof against withering volleys of fire, their loyalty to Abaddon as certain as their armour. In a time when he trusted little but himself, he placed his life in the hands of his close guard without question, and they followed him without hesitation. A last knot of Seventh Legion warriors held the doors to the Sensoria. At a conjuration from Laak, a black cloud blinded them, flickers of warp energy in its heart. Abaddon charged into the gloom, ignoring the sporadic bolt rounds that burst from his warplate. His sword took the head from the first foe he encountered, his fist deflecting the gladius of the second. A bladeslave pounced past, burying its dagger-like limbs into the Space Marine's neck, its momentum carrying them both into the murk. Abaddon pivoted at the sound of heavy footfalls, driving the point of his sword forward to meet the onrushing Imperial fist. He slowed too late, running onto the blade tip. Abaddon advanced, driving the sword on until it erupted from the Space Marine's back. Ripping his sword free, the gloom dissipating as Laak's spell faded, he stepped past the falling body onto the broad chamber of the upper Sensoria.
"We will blind their commanders too," said Laak,
hurrying past, head turning quickly as he surveyed the room.
"Secure the orbital auger channels,"
Abaddon told the Terminator armored legionaries, fanning out into the chamber. His sensor data carried the signals of the rest of the force, dispersing to secure the area against counterattack. Within 30 seconds, the Sensoria was ringed by Sons of Horus.
"Over here, First Captain,"
one of the Justarin replied, indicating a nearby console. Laak strode over, staff leaving trails of sparks where it struck the bloodied floor.
"Yes, this is perfect," crowed the word-bearer's sorcerer.
"I will guide Fox Essence to the auguries to mask the arrival."
"And what of the barrier of the Emperor?"
demanded Abaddon.
"I have seen little enough from you to prize open the shield that guards against the Neverborn."
"That work is ongoing. All elements must come together, Ezekiel."
Laak turned to regard the First Captain with 6 gleaming eyes.
"The gods are with us, and the Utter Blight is growing in strength. Our work here aids the greater plan. Even as Dorne must commit more strength to the defence of the spaceport, his grip on the inner palace is weakened, his eye drawn elsewhere. Progress is being made, though it is not visible to you."
"We are on the brink of taking the port, regardless of your efforts."
"The gods will decide when the spaceport falls, and we shall claim it not a moment earlier."
Laak returned his attention to the console. He drew a curved knife and started etching symbols into the plasteel of the terminal housing. The scratching of its point punctuated his words.
"When we move to the ultimate wall, would you have the elevated Primarchs be balked again? Or shall they lead their legions in the final battle?"
"Fulgrim has already wearied of the attack and withdrawn from the vicinity of the Lion's Gate,"
Abaddon told him.
"Angron rampages without purpose outside the walls, and Mortarion continues his bombardments. I see little to be gained from their participation."
"Horus and his ascended brothers are the chosen of the gods. They are the will of chaos given form,"
the word-bearer replied. He stepped back, looking at his handiwork. The runes glimmered, soft green and dark red.
"To be in their favour is to be favoured by the gods themselves. These are forces you will learn to balance when you come to accept your destiny."
"If it is my destiny, then it will happen whether I accept it or not,"
Abaddon growled.
"You seem keen to persuade me I must make a choice, whilst telling me I have none."
Laak had no response to this, and busied himself at the auger terminal for some time, daubing ritual marks on the console in the blood of the slain. With his staff he ignited the fluids, so that sigils danced in flames, strange intersections of the mystical and mechanical.
"None of this would have been possible without the patronage of the gods," Laak told Abaddon when his ritual was complete. "Victory is not certain except by their favour."
"Victory is never certain."
"Without the gods, your ambitions would have died in a flame-lit lodge on Davin."
A note of anger entered Laak's voice, the first time Abaddon had heard such a thing.
"Without the gods, the War Master's star would have ascended and fallen, and even the shadow of his memory would have eclipsed anything you had achieved."
This time it was Abaddon who was robbed of a retort. He was unsure where the cause and effect lay between Horus seeking the power of chaos and the gods reaching out to him.
"Is it done?"
he asked, pointing towards the auger terminal.
and the sensor array will fail completely.
Layak examined the images that flickered across the screen. Abaddon saw spirals and jags, coming together like waves or overlapping flames. To his eye, they were meaningless shapes.
Falk has seen the beacon and is coming. Darkness will fall when we need it.
Then we will press on, said Abaddon,
clenching his fist.
The Imperial fists strengthen their grip on the sky bridges. It is only a matter of time before we face a counterattack from within the palace. Kroger has extended too far without consolidation, rushing the attack. If we fail to seize our objectives in the next thrust, we will never do it.
And you think you will seize victory by your strength alone?
Layak cackled.
Such hubris.
Abaddon held up a lightning-wreathed glove.
Not by my strength alone, but in a close-fought war, a single blow can turn the course.
Sanctum Imperialis, Western Zone, 4 days since assault. The environs of the Sanctum Imperialis were a sprawling refugee camp. Several thousand square kilometres of habs and dorms and other blocks inside the Eternity Wall had been cleared in preparation for fresh assault. Some, like the Palatine Ark, had been hit by the enemy, turned to rubble, scoured by flame and toxin. Tens of thousands, later hundreds of thousands, had been displaced, fleeing through the Lion's Gate into the city around the Sanctum Imperialis before that impenetrable barbican was closed against the coming of the enemy. The streets throbbed with a different life. Firelight replaced lumens that had been turned off to conserve energy. Against the thundering backdrop of siege guns, the murmur of 1,000 conversations echoed down regal boulevards. Fountains had become wells. Plazas had become markets. Every scrap of material was pressed into use as shelter, transport, or both. And into the mass of humanity, Amon followed Keela.
"I wonder what a custodian sees when he looks upon this," she said, casting out a hand to encompass the mass of people making their homes in the streets, archways, and abandoned buildings. He did not answer straight away. Very little surprised Amon, but he took a small delight in seeing how places could change so dramatically. He had seen the Imperial Palace raised upon the ancient city of its foundations, a city that the Emperor had apparently built in a past age before Old Night, a monument to mankind. Not its master, the Emperor had assured his creations. It had been a place of beauty and awareness of humanity's strengths and frailties, not just a museum, but a building block to the future. A template, not a temple. Function had started to subsume its form. It became a capital, not just of terror, but of a burgeoning empire beyond the stars. The administratum had grown out of the need to officiate such an immense endeavour. Hablocks, arcologies, and hives had appended the statue-flanked processionals and broad cloisters, edifices dedicated to a different kind of deity, laying sacrifice at the idol of bureaucracy, hoping to tame a galaxy with numbers in vid ledgers. The Emperor had been concerned with the Webway project, and the custodians had accompanied him. They had surrendered the greater part of the palace to humans, overseen by Malkador, though not wholly mortal in body, certainly in mindset. It amazed Amon even now to think of the sprawling otherworld a few kilometres beneath his feet, past the wards and gates and bastions of the Imperial dungeon. It also gave him pause to recall the limitless horde of Neverborn that waited below, closed off from terror by arcane machines and the will of the Emperor. The traitors did not need vile rituals to summon their unnatural allies. A legion of the warp tested the defences constantly, the whole dimension yet a paper's breadth away.
"I see the flotsam of a war master's pride," he told her. 7 years ago the Imperium was turned upon its axis by the selfishness of Horus. That moment has led directly to this, and every suffering felt here, every hurt upon the people of the Emperor that has followed, can be laid upon him.
Keela said nothing in reply. Rogal Dorn had come to turn the palace into a fortress. Immense walls, domineering towers and buttresses by the thousand, had strengthened the Sanctum Imperialis, and about it the great curtain fortifications of the Eternity Wall and the Ultimate Wall had been raised and widened, each stretch a city-state in its own right. Administrators remained, but labourers in their millions joined them. The latter were eventually given guns and became soldiers, ordered to defend the ramparts their hands had built. Amon had changed with it all, yet remained constant at his core. Through the Blood Games, he had learned of the ever-shifting societies and ecosystems that existed both in the centre and at the fringes of the Imperial Palace. Some things never changed, like the demagogues and black marketeers and gangsters. Only the means of trade, threat, and payment altered with the passing decades. And in the last months, the palace had metamorphosed into something new again. His presence caused some reaction, a stirring among the listless crowds. But this close to the Sanctum Imperialis, the presence of a custodian was not rare, even if it was not commonplace. A few desperate souls called out petitions for aid, the more unhinged demanding audience with the Emperor himself. Others approached with thanks for the custodian's vigilance, mistaking his presence for one of the irregular patrols through the growing encampments. It is no surprise the dispossessed have a ready ear for the sermons of the Letitia Divinitatis, he said to the self-professed Holy Lady of Terror. When one has no power, one will seek hope from any source.
Indeed,
said Keeler with furrowed brow. They passed across a square dominated by a wide bonfire. Among the flames, Amon recognized the broken shapes of shelving and administratum lecterns. The building on the far side was a counting house, the windows long since broken in, the contents looted. Makeshift lamps flickered inside.
Have you considered the alternative? Keeler continued. If these impoverished folk do not turn their thoughts to worship of the Emperor, where else might they seek succour?
You do not understand the extent of the folly.
I have witnessed firsthand the darkness of the warp that can consume a soul, she replied quietly. You forget that I saw the War Master fall prey to that same delusion.
All the more reason that such knowledge should not be shared widely, Amon told her. He stepped carefully over blanket-wrapped forms. Only the faintest of movements showed them to be alive, not dead, in the grip of deep fatigue and oblivious to everything else.
To accept his own divinity does not suggest any other exists, countered Keeler.
Where did you hear such a thing? Amon asked sharply.
Keeler pulled out a book from a bag over her shoulder.
Amon did not need to look at it closely to know that it was the Lectitio Divinitatis.
It is the wisdom in these pages, she told him.
Yet it is a sentiment that fell from the lips of Lorgar, one who has long since passed from veneration of the Emperor to a far darker life.
Knowledge is power. Ergo, ignorance is weakness, Keeler said. It is a battle into which the Emperor would have his servants go unprepared and unarmed. Is it any wonder that so many have fallen when it appears to them that the Emperor deceived them?
The Emperor is above judgment. I have walked beside him many times and would not claim to know his mind in these matters.
Yet you are sure he would condemn my faith.
To accept any superstitious nonsense invites speculation and unreason. It is the path that leads to the end of everything the Emperor has built. It is to combat those very powers that... Amon fell silent, aware that he should not share too much with Keeler. She had a unique perspective on events around Horus, but the secrecy of the Webway and the Emperor's true goals was inviolate. To know is to be tempted.
I know, and I am not tempted.
She stopped at the steps into the portico of the Administratum building and looked up at Amon's face.
The Emperor gives me the strength to resist their wiles. Did he not create you to be immune to such desires also?
Each custodian is a singular labour, imbued with individual strength and purpose, Amon told her. When Primarchs can be led astray, there is little hope for the common human to withstand the barbs and lures of the hidden foe.
I do not think we will agree, nor that this will be our last discussion on the matter. All I ask is that you approach what you see, she gestured to the building's interior, with an open mind.
And you think I will see something different today? This is the fifth gathering you have brought me to. and all I see are empty rituals and charlatans.
Perhaps that is for the best, from your point of view. What if you were to witness a true miracle of the Emperor? Would you accept it?
Amon said nothing, but simply gestured for Keela to precede him into the counting house. A man and a woman waited in the foyer but remained silent, standing aside to allow them to pass the main stairwell and head towards a hall beyond. Ducking through the arch, Amon found himself in a circular chamber about 30 meters across, the floor muddied from many footfalls, the original mosaic design lost beneath the grime. The ceiling was black with soot from a handful of fires, a few broken skylights acting as chimneys. The first thing that struck him was the singing. Those gathered were mostly knelt in haphazard lines on an old carpet that had been salvaged from somewhere, hands in their laps. He picked out 3 dozen different voices from the assembled worshippers, some of them skilled, many of them not. The effort that went into the singing was not related to the quality of the outcome. He stopped at the threshold for a short while, listening to the words, decoding the euphemism and metaphor as best he could. It was a song of praise, and of hope, and thanks.
"For what do they thank the Emperor?" he quietly asked Keela, who waited beside him. "Their homes are destroyed. They live in abject poverty. It is likely they will die of exposure or violence very soon."
"But they are still alive today," said Keela, eyes glimmering with moisture. She held her hand to her breast, the lump of the book inside her coat beneath it. "The Emperor has guarded them through the tribulation, when so many others have perished."
"Survivor bias is not blessing."
Keela ignored him and entered. Kirill Sinderman had come ahead of the pair to prepare the way, and was leading the verses from in front of the group. There were several others with him, presumably the group leaders. As their presence was noticed, the singing faltered and stopped. The congregation turned their attention to the newcomers, some with gasps, raising hands to mouths in surprise. At first Amon thought it a reaction to his presence, for he had come clad in full panoply, as Keela had suggested. But he heard whispers.
"The Blessed One is here.
She walks among us."
And saw that though eyes strayed to him, they lingered on Keela. It was the first time he had been in the presence of a human, except Malkador, that had commanded more attention than him. Keela responded, her face flushed in the firelight, eyes wide. He heard her heart racing.
"Come! Come!"
Sinderman called out, ushering them to the front of the group. He made introductions, but Amon did not recognize any of the names as people of significance. The congregation were of a kind, much like those he had seen on his previous excursions with Keela. Men and women, mostly older than average, because the younger, healthier ones had all been drafted into the Imperial Army. There were a few he took to be adolescents, not quite old enough to be trained with a lasgun. They looked at him with a mixture of suspicion and awe. The first was due to the illicit nature of the gathering, he had learned, and the second down to his existence as a creation of the Emperor's labours. He found himself uncomfortable under their gaze, but showed nothing of his feelings in his expression, a study in calm interest. And the evening continued in predictable fashion, with a few more songs, some discussion of certain passages from their holy book, and an exchange of goods in the form of food, drink, medicines, and such that had been scavenged since the last gathering. These were taken by the group leaders for distribution to those most in need, or so they claimed. Whether they were true to their word was not Amon's concern. Finally, prayers were offered to the Emperor in exchange for protection, guidance, and forgiveness. The last of these confused Amon particularly. As though the Emperor cared anything for the supposed moral infractions of these people. At the conclusion of the ceremony, Amon approached Sinderman and the other cult leaders.
"It is such an honour to receive your visit, custodian," said a grey-haired woman called Coral.
She looked at him oddly, hand half moving toward his armour and then withdrawing.
"To think that you have been in the presence of the God Emperor."
Amon stiffened on hearing that term, plucked as it was from the forbidden book written by the traitor Lorgar. That it had entered common parlance was testament to the price of laxity. Coral acted as though something of that supposedly divine connection might be passed off by simple proximity.
Sindermann assured us that you are not here to condemn our practices, said another,
a dark-skinned man with a walking cane, dressed in the robe of a minor administrator. Amon glanced at Keela. She raised an eyebrow.
I am seeking those that may have witnessed strange phenomena, said the custodian. A shared vision or dreams, perhaps? Voices, images? Anything that cannot be explained by natural law.
Like signs from the Emperor?
Asked the youngest of the trio, a mother with a babe in a sling, no more than a few months old. Amon realized the child must have been born since the siege began. His surprise must have slipped through his guarded expression.
His father fights on the walls,
the woman said proudly, stroking the babe's cheek. Her voice quavered a little.
At least, he did when I last heard a month ago. I pray to the Emperor to see him safe through his travails. I don't suppose you could get word of him.
She looked at Amon with a hope that was in stark contrast to her sunken features and dark-rimmed eyes. He could see that the child was malnourished also, as were most of the congregation. Their clothes were tatters, homes destroyed. Yet they gave thanks to a fiction of the Emperor, and asked for news of loved ones, rather than decrying the master of mankind, who surely some might blame for their predicament. The sheer scale of the battle for the Imperial Palace meant that any single soldier could not be accounted for. Whole companies died without remark. It did not seem productive to share this point with the desperate young woman.
I do not think it possible, he told her softly.
Life goes on, said the older woman. Horus cannot halt all of humanity.
Indeed, the great cycle continues, said Keela,
joining them, having finished a conversation with one of the congregation. She looked at the mother.
What do you know of the group that meets in the Basilica Ventura?
A strange lot, said the man, limping closer. Gave themselves a name. What was it, Chiquendu, the ones that follow Olivier?
The older woman rubbed her chin for a moment.
The lamp-bearers? Lamp-lighters?
Light-bearers, said the young mother.
I saw one of their emissaries on the West Arch Road just this morning.
Yes,
the light-bearers, said Chiquendu. You want strange happenings, the light-bearers are the ones to watch for sure. Olivier, he's claiming he can heal the sick, and that's just the start of it.
Amon exchanged a look with Keela. She smiled and held her hands out to the group leaders, embracing each in turn.
Stay strong, she whispered to each of them.
My thanks for your assistance, Amon said with a nod of acknowledgement.
He was about to depart, but felt he could not do so without some further comment. It was not his place to fuel false worship, but nor was it his duty to quash all sense of hope.
This time shall pass. The Emperor will prevail.
Chapter 19 Pick a Target. Vox Silence. The Lightbearers. Lionsgate Spaceport, Stratifex Corps, 2 days since assault. Slowly accreting more warriors on the advance, Forex's hidden force had pushed far from the hordes pouring into the base of the spaceport, cutting through several Imperial Army cordons to reach the heart of the Stratifex. It transpired that the rendezvous point Forex had selected was located in a nest of habdorms clustered about one of the main dropshafts. Civilians with autoguns and kitchen knives had proved less of an obstacle than the distance to cover, their bodies left cooling in the passageways and rooms they had called home. The advance had not gone unnoticed, indeed was not meant to be wholly clandestine. With the defenders unsure of the threat posed by the Iron Warriors, several scouting forces had been sent after them, each greeted by a sudden and overwhelming counterattack. To Forex, it seemed that the Imperial Army colonel, or whoever was in charge of the sector, had finally decided enough was enough and dispatched a company-level force to deal with the interlopers. As soon as the auger pickets had detected the incoming soldiers, Forex had responded, setting ambushes and a mobile reserve. 20 minutes had passed since the first shot had been fired, and more army personnel were being thrown into the fight. A few mortars and support guns had been brought to bear. Frag bombs and armor-piercing shells, forcing the Iron Warriors into a more defensive mode around the central Hab cluster. The Warsmith was keenly aware that his mission to draw the enemy away from the coming offensive above and below was starting to have an effect. It was hard to pick out what Garal was saying over the sound of bolters and thud of shells landing not far above Forex's position, though his second-in-command was only a few meters away. "It's safe to break Vox silence now," Forex transmitted to the captain. A red lasblast slashed across his left pauldron, leaving a grey mark through his insignia. "I think they know where we are." "Counteroffensive is still sporadic, Triarch," the captain told him. "I can confirm 811 warriors have reached the rendezvous." "We've been inside more than 24 hours. I don't expect anyone else to make it to us."
"No, Triarch. What are your orders?"
"No contact from either the aerial attack wave or the surface reinforcements." As soon as he asked the question, Forex realized it was redundant. "Forget that. You'd have told me if there was."
"All squads are currently on perimeter guard or mobile reserve assignments, Triarch. This is a defensible position. Ingress and exit is only via four corridors. Should we dig in?"
"Easy to defend, but if we get stuck here, very hard to break out. The longer we stay, the more chance we'll get bogged down by an insignificant defense force. To draw their attention, we need to pose more of a threat. I'm not going to wait for any more stragglers. It's time to identify a target and push this shiv a bit deeper."
Another enemy thrust along the passage to the east drew Forex's eye. Scores of troopers in plated carapace armor led the fresh offensive, daring the bolter fusillade as they dashed from one doorway to the next. They'd lost half their number in the first 15 meters. He could not decide if they were brave or stupid to try a forced attack against his space marines.
"I have some schematics, Triarch."
Garal pushed through the squad protecting Forex and proffered a slate projector, its surface crisscrossed with a wireframe rendition of their surroundings.
"There are a number of potential targets within 3 kilometers of our position."
"The point of our attack is to open up a front inside the spaceport to allow the upper and lower forces to push forward in strength. These lackluster assaults will bog us down, but they aren't a significant commitment. Every bolt we have could kill a trooper and will achieve nothing. It is Dawn's sons that are the spine of this defense. I need to make sure the Imperial Fists deploy in numbers against us."
"So what does that mean? What objective do we aim for?"
"Once we've cleared away this chaff, send out 8 scouting forces, 10 legionaries each. I want even dispersal, vertically and horizontally, as far as they can go. Have each report levels of resistance every 200 meters. In particular, keep an eye out for our cousins in yellow. Any contact with Imperial Fists must be signalled immediately."
"Yes, Triarch."
Garal's uncertainty was betrayed by his wavering affirmative. "What are they seeking?"
"Whichever force encounters the greatest increase in resistance is the one we shall follow."
The armoured Imperial troopers pushed on again, using their surge to cover the arrival of a pair of tripod-mounted multi-lasers. Soon, rapid-fire beams of blue burst along the eastern corridor, sparking from the armour of Forex's warriors and leaving scorch marks along the pale yellow walls. Missiles and heavy bolters roared in reply, turning their heavy weapons and their crews to broken metal and flesh.
Excuse my ignorance, Triarch. Why would we knowingly advance into the hardest defense?"
"If you were defending the spaceport, and you had enemy roaming at will, how would you organize your troops?"
"I would assign defenders based on a scale of significance and vulnerability. The greater the value of a potential objective, the better defense..."
Garal laughed as he reached his conclusion.
"The best defenses will be arrayed around the targets that are worth the most to our enemy."
"Exactly. It doesn't matter what we attack, only that the Imperial Fists prize it highly. The more they fight to defend it, the greater its value to them."
"And when we have identified the target, Triarch?"
"We move in full force, rapid spearpoint assault. We'll break the defense, seize whatever it is the Sons of Dawn are trying to protect, and then prepare ourselves for the counterattack. The greater their response, the better we're doing."
Nagapur Territories, 59 days before assault. The scale of the damage was hard to take in. As Zenobi looked along half a kilometre of twisted, burning metal, it reminded her of the time when, as a child, she had seen a furnace implosion.
Even that didn't really compare. The brief, violent episode that had slain hundreds but caused little permanent damage to the production line of the Cradle Spur. At least 17 carriages and gun cars had been derailed completely, including the one Zenobi had been in. Half a dozen more had skipped the tracks and were listing one way or the other, zigzagged together by the sudden slowing of the train. The frontmost four cars showed signs of hits but were otherwise intact, as were the last dozen or so. It was not the sight that reminded her of the flash fire back in Adaba. It was the smell. Charring bodies and burning oil. It brought the memory back, stark and hot, her parents screaming for lost relatives. It was calmer here. The immediate mayhem had subsided while she'd been trapped in the turret. Search teams picked through the wrecks that were not alight, pulling free the living and the dead. A steady stream of wounded, walking and stretchered, passed by to the rough Medicaid stations that had been set up away from the train. With a shock that brought her aimless pacing to a halt, Zenobi remembered the aircraft. She looked up, scanning the smoke-smudged heavens. Dusk tinged the sky with purples and reds.
They left.
Zenobi turned at the sound of Celine's voice. Menba was just behind her, a spare uniform in his arms.
Put this on.
It'll be getting colder, he said, passing her the coverall. She struggled into the bulky uniform, which was made for someone at least 5 centimeters taller. She folded up the cuffs, and it bunched around her ankles, out the top of her boots.
I feel like a child, she said, flopping her arms up and down. You're not, cousin, said Memba. You a smart woman, Celine told her. Good thinking. Using your uniform to put out that fire. That's a bright brain inside your skull. Do we know who's dead yet?
Zenobi asked quietly, surveying the wreckage.
Sergeant Alexander, said Celine, swallowing hard.
Zenobi choked back a sob, and Memba held her arm as she swayed.
Come on, sit down,
he said, leading her away from the burning train. She took several steps and then shook her head, pulling herself away.
I can help,
she told him, wiping soot and tears from her face with the sleeve of her new clothes.
I'm not hurt. You took in a lot of smoke, Obi, said Celine. That's not good. I'm not hurt,
insisted Zenobi, starting back towards the carriage behind the gunnery car.
And the company banner is in there somewhere.
She saw the two of them exchange a glance.
It's important,
Zenobi insisted. There were two piles of bodies, one at each end of the car a few meters from the doors. The whole carriage had tipped along with the gunnery carriage, but there was space between them to get to the entrances. Zenobi squeezed through easily enough, once again thankful for her small size. It was strange to see everything at a right angle to its former position. She walked along the wall between the ends of the benches and the windows, trying to find where she had stowed the banner. There were puddles and smears of blood on the painted metal, and a few hands and feet stuck out from under the mangled remains of benches that had come loose from their fastenings, too entangled to be removed. The roof was on her left, the hammocks still bundled where they had been before the attack. Luckily, there had been no fire here, or perhaps it was something more than luck, she thought. She remembered what the Beta Platoon trooper had tried to tell her, about powers greater than her. Maybe there was a force that was protecting the standard, the physical proof of her loyalty and dedication to the cause. She found the banner pole, but it was stuck behind the webbing of the hammock. Looking around, she found a bayonet that had slipped from a kit bag. She used it to saw through the straps, until she, the hammock, and the banner pole fell backwards, tumbling over a bench.
You okay?
Memba called from the door, his shock of curled hair silhouetted against the ruddy twilight.
Fine, cousin.
Zenobi struggled to her feet, untangling the hammock from her boot. She picked her way back to the door, slipping twice on drying blood. Coming out into the open air made her realize how dark it had been inside the carriage, though day was rapidly giving way to night time. Flames added to the crimson illumination, and by its light she saw integrity officers moving through the gangs of labouring troopers. One of them approached the gathering members of Epsilon Platoon and other scattered company soldiers.
"Any Vox sets here?"
she asked. One hand was on her holstered pistol, a slender disciplinary cane in the other.
"Yeah, I got the platoon set," said Bellet,
pointing to a bulky transmitter box that was set on the dirt nearby. There were lasguns, power packs, and a few rations boxes heaped next to it. The integrity officer walked over to the vox set, raised a booted foot, and stamped hard on the communications equipment. The box was sturdy and hardly bent under the blow.
What are you doing?
Belle took a few steps towards her, amidst cries from the others, but a glare from the integrity officer stopped him mid-stride and silenced the rest. She kicked the set over, exposing the speaker to her descending heel. Again and again, she drove her boot into the controls, until grille, dials, and internal circuits were scattered about, sparks and crackles emitting from the dying voxcaster.
What was that for?
Asked Zenobi. She regretted the outburst, but was still unsettled from her recent trauma, and couldn't stop the words coming out.
We might need that. There will be no unauthorized transmissions. Several vox sets will be retained for core command.
The integrity officer stepped closer, looking at each of them.
Someone tried to contact the incoming aircraft prior to the attack.
Zenobi drew in a breath, exchanging glances with the others nearby.
What happened to them?
Asked Ketai.
Dead. In the attack,
replied the integrity officer, scowling.
Unfortunate that she died before we could learn if there were any others that thought as she did.
The integrity officer drew away from them, cane swishing in her hand.
The closer we come to the battle, the greater the risk of treachery. There can be no complacency.
Yes, Banner Madam,
said Ketai, snapping off a salute.
Get down to the intact carriages. Work parties are separating the locomotive and functional cars. You'll be detailed your labours. There's no way we can move this mess.
A sweeping cane indicated the buckled remains of the train's middle cars.
So, we'll be walking the rest of the way to the palace.
Basilica Ventura, 5 days since assault. Tequila, the encampment of the light-bearers, was to the shanty shrines as the Sanctum Imperialis was to the shack of a tollkeeper. In the ever-twilight of the besieged imperial palace, gloom had become the norm, but the light-bearers had decided to be literal with their name. By some means they had reactivated the energy grid around the Basilica Ventura, which was a gate-keep that guarded the Via Occidentus. The forbidding walls of the Barbican were hung with brightly coloured lights, and the rooftop avenue that led to it was lined with lampposts, gleaming with red and blue lumens. Most of the palace was in collapse nearby, having been struck by several orbital lance bursts during a failure of the Aegis. Into the desolation, a small sect of the Lictitia Divinitatis had ventured, Keeler had learned, led by a man called Olivier Musnitz. There was little known about him from before his arrival a few weeks earlier, but already the light-bearers numbered several hundred devotees. They were sending out messengers to other groups of the Lictitia Divinitatis, actively inviting members to come and join them. This certainly was not a furtive prayer meet in an abandoned tithe house. Keeler was surprised by the number of people that were gathering. It was late evening, though nothing could be seen of stars and moon through the storm above the palace. Ranging from individuals to extended families, the faithful of the light-bearers climbed up through the broken ruin of a scriptorum and onto the Via Occidentus, which ran towards the western districts. The imposing towers and domes of the Capitol Imperator loomed above them, shadowed against the faint glimmer of void shields. Keeler had come alone, wanting to see for herself the nature of the light-bearer's rituals, without the distraction of Amon's presence. The custodian's desire to investigate had been placated by a promise that she would meet with him the next morning and report everything she witnessed. In addition, she wore a brooch shaped like a rose, into which had been secured a miniature picked recorder, so that Amon could review the encounter himself. The immense double doors of the basilica were open, more light spilling from inside, bathing the brickwork road in a yellow glow. Everything seemed clean compared to the shanties that held sway everywhere else, with barely a piece of grit to mar the swept pathway. Half a dozen children stood at the doors, handing out small lanterns, made from the pierced casings of large-bore cannons, with twisted wire for handles. She wasn't sure what had been used for the oil within, but assumed it had been salvaged from one of the hundreds of downed planes that had fallen around the palace during the height of the aerial battle. Nobody gave Keeler a second glance as she took up one of the lamps and stepped within. The basilica itself had been almost hollowed out by a blast that had pierced the roof. Floors and walkways of metal sheets and wooden planks covered the hole that burrowed half a kilometre down into the body of the Sanctum Imperialis's foundations, and parts of the upper levels remained like mezzanines, lined with more of the faithful. The glow of so many lanterns suffused everything with visual warmth, and Keeler could feel a spirit of welcome embracing her as she ascended a ramp to the nearest level. She found a place between several families. There were all ages here, including a few attendees in their Imperial Army uniforms. Smiles greeted her, but thankfully no questions. About half an hour passed until the doors swung closed, leaving only the light of the lanterns that spiralled up the inside of the basilica. About halfway up, some 40 meters above the doors, a curtain was pulled back from an archway, and a youthful man stepped out, flanked by a pair of older women. They were dressed in identical robes of white and yellow, a glittering of metallic thread around collar, hem, and cuff. All three had shaved heads, a sheen of perspiration on their hairless scalps. The two women each carried a large volume, bound in black leather, or mock leather, embossed with silver writing. Many scraps of paper jutted from between the pages, marking particular passages of what Keeler knew to be the Book of Divinity. Her hand moved to her far humbler copy beneath her dress, and saw others around her doing likewise, the book itself as much a totem as a reference work. Olivier Muznik, for such it had to be, advanced a few paces further than his companions, his hands clasped to his belly. There was a softness about him, a little flesh on the jowls, a bit of a paunch at the waist. Unusual in such dire times, when so many ate only rarely. On further study, Keeler saw a looseness in the skin that suggested Olivier had been carrying a lot more weight until recently. He wasn't putting himself above the food shortages suffered by his congregation.
"Faithful,"
he declared, raising his hands. He had a soft voice, smooth and assured, an accent that Keeler couldn't exactly place, but which brought to mind the Europa hives. Despite his tempered demeanour, his words carried well in the confines of the makeshift temple.
"Raise up your lights, so that we might feel the gaze of the Emperor in the darkness."
The congregation lifted their lamps, and Keeler copied them. Though each offered but a small yellow flicker, the combined effect of so many tallow lights was a warm suffusing of the basilica's interior. As flames danced in the draughts, shapes moved in half-shadow on the walls.
"Feel the breath of the Emperor entering your lungs,"
Olivier said, commanding but gentle. Keeler took a breath. She tasted tallow smoke and sweat, and impossibly she thought she could smell blossom, the fragrance of night rose that used to grow near her window when she was a child. Delicate gasps from others around her revealed that she was not alone in the experience. Her gaze drifted between Olivier and the near-invisible movement of the wall shadows. His voice continued, hypnotic and low.
"Feel the hands of the Emperor lift you up."
The basilica faded as the shadow images grew clearer. Olivier's voice was a breeze in the swaying bushes that surrounded Keeler. There was long grass under her bare feet. All about her the wind stirred a beautiful garden. Not an ornate, ordered plot, but a natural flourishing of wildflowers and heathland, which stretched onto far hills broken by copses of golden-leafed trees. Her eyes were open as she wandered, taking in the bucolic voice of the wind, the buzz of insects and creaking of bending tree trunks. She walked slowly, with purpose, gazing upon each flower as though it were a newly revealed wonder, the warmth of the sun always on her back, no matter where she turned. She tried to see the sun, to look upon its brightness, but the light was omnipresent, yet without source. Keeler told herself that it was not wise to look upon the font of this power. To gaze upon the soul of the Emperor was to see into the heart of divinity. The sons and daughters of the Navis Nobilitae had been bred over generations that they might see the chink of the Emperor's spirit that was the Astronomican. To see it in full splendour would surely shred one's own soul from the body. She was drawn across a babbling brook into a broad pasture, where she came upon the greatest tree she had ever seen. How she had not observed it before defied logic, but she knew this was a place of faith, not reason, and accepted it as such. The tree stretched beyond the clouds, its sprawling limbs holding up the vault of the heavens themselves. The branches quivered with life, bending beneath their burden. And from this came a tremendous creaking. She listened a while, trying to hear the voice of the Emperor in the sound of the tree. Her transition back to reality was abrupt, but not harsh, like waking naturally from a deep slumber, refreshed and clear of thought. She heard weeping, but those around her shed tears of joy, not woe, clasping each other in their shared ecstasy. She took a moment to steady herself, unsure of her own body. A man in late middle age approached her, a broad smile on his face, eyes alive with delight.
"Did you see the tree?"
she asked, wanting to share the feeling that bubbled inside her breast.
"A tree?" he laughed. "I followed the rose path. You saw a tree?"
"The Lord of Trees. The strength of the Emperor holding his shield above us," Keela confessed. "It was incredible."
The man's eyes widened further, and he reached for her arm.
"Oh, amazing! Come, come, you must tell Olivier of your journey."
She allowed herself to be led around the rampway until she was brought before the head of the light-bearers. His gaze turned to her as she approached, his eyes a startling green, reminding her of the verdant gardens.
"Olivier!
How can I help you?"